previously on Popping Collars.
Well, I mean, first of all, let's get real. Episcopal priests who just have MDivs, we're not experts in anything either.
Nope.
Really, we're not. We're professionals. We have, but you know, we're not.
That's true.
That's why we're doing this podcast.
Uh-oh, watch out, bro.
So let's put that aside.
Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection of faith and popular culture. My name is Betsy Gonzalez. I'm coming to you from Alexandria, Virginia. With me are my co-hosts, Liz Easton in Omaha, Nebraska. Hello, Liz.
Hey, Betsy.
We also have got Ricardo Avila coming to us from Long Beach, California. Hello, Ricardo.
Hi, Betsy.
Hello. And our special guest this episode, bringing our age demos way down, is high school senior Selena Sagai of Chicago, Illinois. Hello and welcome, Selena.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So glad you're here. Everyone, this is our 55th episode of Popping Collars, and today's show is about a story told in three acts, a story of self-discovery, survival, and human connection told through the eyes of a young Black man, Chiron, growing up in a rough neighborhood in Miami. It is personal, it is poetic, and it paints images that imprint on your brain. It is the award-winning and Oscar-nominated film Moonlight, directed and written by Barry Jenkins and based on the stage play in Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. So we've watched this movie. It is very lush and beautiful and colorful. And what I was always struck with in the movie was the way they would almost take pictures for you, like these lingering images that the cinematography would just kind of stick with and really burn those into you. So I'm curious, when you think of the movie, you know, what visual comes to your mind? Which stage of life are you kind of with Chiron?
The image, there are two images, and I'll just go with one. The one that sticks with me is of Kevin at the jukebox when he starts to play the song that made him think of Chiron and call him back. And there's just a look on Kevin's face after he presses play of this, like, to me, expectancy. Like, what will he think when he realizes this song made me think of him? And it's a song, I can't think of the title, but it's about, you know, oh, it seems like a mighty long time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Shoo-bop, shoo-bop, my baby. Mm-hmm. Hasn't seen him in so long. Mm-hmm. And the jukebox is right there, and it's Kevin in his white shirt because he's a cook. And it's just that look on his face. It's just expectant and waiting. It was like a freeze frame for me.
Selena, what about you?
The first part of the movie, when he was a child, I think it's Chiron, like, trying to figure out who he's supposed to be in this environment where he's supposed to be like everyone else. But everybody thinks he's something totally different. Mm-hmm. He's kind of alienated in that respect. And it's just common. I think that's the only thing I can say about it. It's just, it reminds me so much of just being like in my neighborhood and figuring out who I was, but having all these people say like you're this and you're that, like without you even knowing that you're this and you're that. Like, I think that's the thing that really like stuck with me with that scene and that portion of his life. And I think that's why I think I cried the most in that first part of the movie was when he was a child. It's like I felt so much of that child within like an experience I probably had that was so much aligned in a way that was, I didn't expect it. I didn't even know what Moonlight was about until I went to go see it, and to find so many similarities as I watch it. It took a lot.
So in true Popping Collars tradition, I haven't actually seen the movie.
Yes, that's typical, Liz.
That's the role that I play on our show. I just can't get it together with the screeners, unfortunately. But I read a ton about it today, and now I really want to see it. And I've read all the spoilers, so that's kind of a bummer. I think that...
Well, we were going to spoil it for you anyway.
Well, exactly. I knew that was going to happen, but I really want to see it. But one of the images that kept coming up in the media about this was the scene of the kind of surrogate dad figure. What's his
Juan.
Name?
Juan.
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 Teaching him how to swim and floating in the ocean. And mm-hmm. I thought that was a really loving and lovely image in this kind of rich landscape. And it seems to build on this theme that I read about and that you guys have talked about. about male affection and intimacy and identity and how all of that is expressed, and safety and vulnerability and violence and all the rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the water, we can go into some, you know, whenever you're looking for religious overtones and water shows up, I mean, it's a, you know, it's a bonanza of opportunities, right? You know, that, I mean, he's almost essentially in kind of this baptismal kind of look and this floating. And that's kind of, because that was also an image too, Liz, I saw before I saw the movie. But then the way that scene is shot, that where the camera is,
right,
it's not up. It's almost you get this drowning feeling. I don't know whether anybody else had this, like all this water, like on me. And I kind of didn't quite know that was a deliberate choice, but what that choice was really about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was right at water level. Mm-hmm. I remember that. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the choice was about. I do know that it gave me a sense of, it was like, it could go either way. He could fall under the water or he could float. And what to me was key in that scene was Juan saying to him a couple of times, he's like, don't worry, I've got you. Nothing is going to happen to you. Trust me and just kind of let go and let yourself float. That to me was kind of the key thing about that scene. Like, how often did this kid have that promise and have it kept in his life? I've got you and you don't have to worry.
I read an article. Let me tell you about an article I read. About, it was about the playwright. It was in The Guardian. It was just a really beautiful sort of his story as a playwright. And then he wrote parts, especially of the third act of the film. But that Juan is based on a man in his life. His name was Blue. And it was a very, very similar relationship. And he said that actor captured the character so much that at an awards show, the actor was straightening the writer's bow tie and the writer just collapsed in tears, like lost it, you know, and was like, he had to stand there being held for a long time because for him, it was like such a perfect capture of this man who meant the world to him in also a very kind of morally ambiguous way. Expelling our myths about what a good, you know, quote, good man ought to be and what those relationships are like. And I just thought that was a really touching little story.
Selena, what'd you think about Juan?
From the moment he was shown and presented into the movie, he seemed like he cared about people more than expected. Like when he rolls up on the corner and he's about to go up to this kid that just started dealing for him, he asked about his mom and how she's doing and, like, is she okay? Right. And, like, don't mess up. Or just, you know, do it for your mom kind of mentality. Like, don't get caught up kind of, like, in the fad of, like, being on the streets and, like, being that guy on the streets. You know, I think that was something he always tried to highlight because I don't even think he glorified himself as some man on the street. He obviously didn't glorify himself because at the end of the first scene, you know, the first act, you could say, he seemed so disappointed in himself for letting Chiron down and like being the person that, you know, supplied his own mother with Chiron's mother with drugs. Like, he wasn't proud of that, and I could tell. Like, and I think that's why, and I don't think he felt obligated to take care of Chiron because of that fact. He truly cared about Chiron before he even knew that he was dealing with his mom, which also I think highlights how much of a good man he was. Even if morally, like, he knew what he was doing was wrong, he tried so much to make it right in so many different ways, even before knowing that it was directly, like, what he did for his life was directly affecting someone else's life.
I'm going to make a little statement, and then if this is the right time, I'm going to make a big statement. But it's kind of...
Go for it.
Betsy, you're so good. You always are the good enabler for just going for it.
Great.
I assume she's like that as a person at school, too. So
definitely.
Good. So... To me, Juan, first of all, what I see in him is like it's a masculinity that could be violent but isn't. And somehow, you know, that works. So when I say that everything about him upends what I think is going to happen, it's everything. You know, he goes and talks to one of his workers on the street, as Selena was saying, and asks about his mother. and says she's in his prayers. Later on, he has some sort of code that no one should be doing drugs right there in the area. So he goes to the car and finds out that it's Chiron's mother in the car. But he's got those rules, you know. He's like, he may be dealing drugs, but there are standards. The way he answers, like you said, the question of, like, what's a faggot? I thought, uh-oh, here's where it's going to go bad. But he says this more reasonable thing than I think I could have come up with even. He says, you know, it's a name that people use to make gay people feel bad about themselves. And that whole thing of, like, you don't know who you're going to be. You know, that might not be true for you, but that's what that word means. It's just so even-handed. And Teresa chimes in. He, you know, the whole swimming thing, how respectful he is with the mother, even though he sees she's on drugs. I don't know. It's just everywhere. And then also just that he is a drug dealer, but he has this, you know, oh, it's a movie about drugs. There's going to be a shootout. You know, you keep seeing that street. You're like, where's the gun going to come from? And it doesn't.
The question, what I think is interesting about that, Ricardo, is maybe too obvious to even bring up, but what does that tell us about our assumptions about Black men based primarily on the media that we consume, right? Like, this wasn't The Wire, but everyone, you know, is sort of like thinking it might be, right. You know, and what is it? And because the truth is that for people of every race, there are conflicts about identity. And about sexuality and about, you know, the roles that we play in one another's lives. And it's also true that there are particularities about the experience of Black people in the U.S. and particularly Black men. And that's why I think it's so wonderful that there are no white people in this entire film. White people like me can't watch and be like, see, it's about all of us. It's really a story about all of us. It's not a story about all of us. It's a very particular story about these people, and then the way that all of those stereotypes that you mentioned, or sort of assumptions that you mentioned, Ricardo, there's this tension that's created because they never come to pass, and that can be uncomfortable.
That's another way this movie just kind of totally fights back all of these stereotypes and these expectations of Black men, specifically Black men. Even if, you know, there's Black women obviously in this movie, I see a lot of this is like an ode to Black men, and like, it's okay to be a different Black man. And like, that's something you never hear, and like, you never see that in the Black men community. Like, I strongly love to, like, I'm so for empowering Black men in a different way, like letting them be a different type of masculine, and maybe not even being masculine, being whatever it is you want to be. I think that's such a mold that Black men don't get to ever fit into, because it's just so abstract in the Black community for Black men. And I think that's why that's just another reason why the movie is just amazing in itself. I think it's such a great, it's almost like a For Colored Girls for Black men.
Yeah. And it your comment reminds me of kind of the way we've been talking about, even beyond race, the idea of gender. And if we really want, you know, as especially in the wake of the Women's March and all those sorts of things, just if we want freedom, and freedom to express ourselves as women in any way we want, where that the heart of some of that begins is for men to have that freedom too.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
That, yeah. Then, you know, then if we can, you know, the idea of being free to be how you are going to be and embracing that, then it will lead to my freedom too. You know, I think they go hand in hand.
Well, mm-hmm. And the patriarchy hurts us all, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. a common refrain around our office, that like, you can't assume that women, you know, women who grew up in a patriarchal system, you can't assume them to not have patriarchal assumptions. And you can't assume that men haven't been wounded by the patriarchy in the same way. And I think it's true for racism. You know, it's true for all of these levels of oppression, that they all, you know, that's what intersectionality is, right? Like, we're all going to be liberated, or none of us is going to be liberated. And that's hard. And in this moment, in this political climate, I feel like some of the conversations that I'm having creates a hierarchy of oppression. So like, you know, my oppression is worse than yours, so I need you to stop talking right now, which is certainly appropriate at some times and in some places. But at the end of the day, we're going to get this when feminists say trans rights are really important to me. And when trans people say Black Lives Matter.
It's this inner life of this one character in these three sections, and you start to suddenly realize, oh, this is about Chiron. This is about his journey, about his discovery, and they're going to tell it to you in a way that you weren't expecting it. And we're not going to step into cliche. We're going to have this be a story that you're not going to necessarily see coming. And so turn it on its head. I like that.
It wasn't what we would call a stereotypically African-American film. I don't see that many movies to know quite what I'm talking about, but you know how there are those like romantic movies where there are like five different couples and one of them is always the actor who was in Rent, Taye Diggs, is that his name?
Yeah,
he's always in those movies.
Best Man's Holiday.
Right, exactly.
Tearjerker, I love that movie.
I haven't seen it.
Oh,
but
it's great.
As a Mexican American viewer, but pretty assimilated, I think of that movie as in the genre of black movies targeted at black people, and I may be wrong, but this movie, I'm dealing in stereotypes here, but it didn't feel like that stereotypical black movie. It felt like a universal movie. But see, now I'm not black, so I don't know. But for me, it's like when I hear the classical music, that was my first cue. It's like, okay, that's interesting, because there was just a drug deal and these are all black kids on the playground, but the music is Mozart. And what does that mean? So it's like kind of telling you, you know, all the expectations you have about people and about movies, this ain't where it's at right now. I'm going to show you that these are human beings. And I thought of it as more a gay movie than a black movie, from my perspective, being a gay man, and all the coming out and all the identity stuff. So I don't know how it might be for someone who's African-American.
I agree 100% on that. I think that with movies like Boys in the Hood, which I had recently just fully watched like maybe 2 years ago, it's like there's movies that definitely I feel like appeal to a certain black audience because it's a certain black stereotype of what it is to be black, what it is to live in the hood and be black and how it acts like in this, that, and the third. And like, I live on the north side of Chicago, but it doesn't mean I live on the good side, because the south side is stereotypically the bad side, the black side, and the hood side. I live in just as much of a hood as, you know, you would like to call any other hood, but, you know, it's what I saw living in my neighborhood. It was so completely polarizing from what I saw from the movie, which was refreshing. It was just so much more refreshing, because there's so many stigmas being in a neighborhood with mostly, you know, predominantly black people. And like, I'm Eritrean American. Like, my parents are from a whole other country. Like, I'm first generation Eritrean American. And like, that's even such a, you know, stigmatized view of like me, because I'm not, you know, I'm not black. I know where I'm from. That's kind of like that whole thing about, you know, you're not really black if you know where you're from. That's all these different stereotypes that, you know, you go through living in like a neighborhood, you know, that's like the hood or like anything like that. And I think that there's times where even watching Boys in the Hood, you know, I know I'm from the hood pretty much, but like, I didn't really feel like I was from the hood. I never saw one of my friends get shot up. That's scary. Like, I never been through that. And it makes you kind of feel like that's kind of, you're not really a part of that type of experience. You're not a part of that black experience, that certain type of experience. But with this movie, it's like, I didn't feel like I was different from any character from that movie. Like, I mean, I don't have a mother who's a crackhead. I don't have, I don't have a friend that I'm, you know, I don't have a friend of the same sex that I'm in a relationship with that's also black, or a person of color. But I mean, it didn't matter. Like, I felt like there were so many different barriers they broke in terms of trying to separate themselves from a typical black movie and being like portraying a typical black person's life in the hood. It just, I think the reason why it's so easy to identify with the movie is because it's about finding your identity. And like, that's what makes it so easy to identify with it. It's, everybody has to go through that. Even if you're from the hood and there's so many different stereotypes about being a person in the hood, you need to find yourself outside from that hood mentality.
Yeah, well, in the Trinity, we have this kind of Trinitarian thing happening. So we have three actors playing two roles in the movie. So there's three Kevins and there's three Chirones. And us just talking about this, it kind of made me want to, like, I want to go home with Kevin a little bit. Like, what's Kevin's life? Like, you know, we see him as kind of, you know, it seems like a pretty standard little kid, right? Running around, doing the things. And let's compare, you know, our stuff and the playing and the, you know, that sort of thing. And then he's kind of got down, especially in the middle, like teen Kevin and teen Chiron. Kevin kind of has down what his front is going to be. You know, I'm in detention because I was, you know, with this girl in the stairwell and all that kind of stuff. And he's kind of got down however he's operating in the world. His code switching, at least in terms of being straight and gay, perhaps, or just he's kind of got something that's working, even though he has to go with the flow when the bully is like, you have to do this. You know, he's still under the suppression of the scene, but to then still have Chiron get to that. I loved the grills he was wearing in the final act. And when Kevin calls them fronts, right. You know, it was fronts.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of like, it's like fronting. Like he's, you know, this is all mask. And it's so mask, you know, that even my teeth are a part of the mask. So I can kind of hold in whatever it is I'm trying to hide, that kind of way.
And like in that respect, like that's the only reason why Kevin even said it was because I think he had finally, in that last portion of the movie, he was so content with himself. He was so content with his identity and what he was. He didn't care that he was a cook. He was happy he was a cook because it was something he was good at, it was something he liked, and it was the first time he ever really felt like he was making something of himself that was for himself and not for anyone else. It was for him and his kid, and then that was it. And you know, he didn't have that restriction that he had when he was younger, and now he sees it with Chiron, who goes by Black at the end of the movie, which is something he didn't even want to be called when he was born by Chiron when he was an adolescent. And that was what Kevin always called him. And it was like, it's crazy to see the shift. Like, that's like, it's just like this weird, like, role reversal between them, where it's someone who was so, not even uncomfortable, was so comfortable with switching who he was on and off all the time, becomes so aware of the fact that that's what someone else is doing now because he's so aware of himself. And I think that was something that was really interesting that I saw with Kevin. And that's what made me like Kevin more than I did, especially in the scene where he, you know, he went and he did what he did. Mm-hmm. That scene was, you know, even in that moment, I think Kevin was so conflicted because he was like, don't get up, Chiron, don't get up. Or Chiron, don't get up. And it was like, you could see it. It's like he didn't want to be under that suppression, but it was so hard because he didn't know who he was yet. He wasn't aware of it still, but he knew that he didn't want to hurt Chiron. He didn't want to do anything to Chiron because he cared about him. And I think that at the end, you see that care come back full circle, but it's without any restriction. And that's like the tenderness that you see like at the end when he's stroking his head and like just there for him and it's nothing else happens. And even at the end, I felt like some emptiness. I was like, is this the end? Like, that's how it's going to end. But I felt so much warmth at the end too. I was like, I'm so happy that's how it played out. Like, that's what I wanted, I think, from the get-go. So it was, I think that also is a good way to kind of put Kevin full circle.
Caetano Veloso singing that song, Cucurucucu Paloma, when he's driving from Georgia to Florida to hopefully meet up with Kevin, with all that longing he's held. That song is about, it's in Spanish, but it's about longing and unrequited love. And it's this beautiful, sad song on the road. It's gorgeous. It's got levels. I feel like I'm rambling now, but there's so many ways in which this movie just kind of hits you sideways instead of coming right at you and telling you what you should think. It really sits with you, and it is like a poem. I've heard people say that, and I'm like, yeah, people say that all the time. But it is like a poem. The words evoke something, and you don't quite know what until you sit with them or read it over again. I think this movie bears repeat viewings for sure. Moon tonight, your candles burn bright, soothing me softly in your silver light. Oh, friend of mine, your vision is divine, so your secrets on the patchwork of time. Thank you.
now time has come in the podcast kind of right at the end here where we do our employee picks. Now, Selena, there used to be these things called video rental stores.
I have been to many of those.
What? Okay.
I've been to a Blockbuster, a Hollywood Video. Oh,
at a museum? Were you at a museum or something?
I don't feel as old all of a sudden. That's awesome.
Okay, that was like my favorite
thing. Okay, so there we go. Okay. So what we're talking about is like there'll be like that wall at the Blockbuster for all the people who work there to like be like Sharon's picks. And there would be like Sharon's big chance, time to shine. She's gonna put out some really weird stuff or something really interesting. You know, Sharon endorses this, or John or Michael or whatever. So we kind of will put out our own employee picks, kind of see what we're into at the moment. And so Liz said, you've got a pick to put up on that very small little shelf on the wall. So Liz, what have you got?
So I've really been in a TV and media rut lately. Like, I haven't had a great thing to binge on. So I can't wholly endorse this, although I enjoyed it. So I commend it to you. The new Amazon series Z, which is are you watching it too?
I watched it.
It's great. So it's sort of the, you know, it looks like there will be other seasons, but it's sort of a bio series about Zelda Fitzgerald. Who I don't know a whole lot about. I, you know, maybe had read a little bit of her work and knew her really only as Daisy in Great Gatsby, like as the inspiration for Daisy in the Great Gatsby, which I hated the Great Gatsby. Do you guys still read that in high school?
Yeah, but I didn't read it, to be fairly honest. I have not really read.
I hated it.
Per se.
Why did you hate it?
I remembered when I was in high school reading it, and I went to a Jesuit prep school in Seattle, and I just remember being like, God, I hope my teachers aren't listening to this. Like, I'm surrounded by these dudes all day long. I don't want to read about them. Like I don't want to read. Like, not a lot has changed. It was just this sort of glorified excess about riches, and I think at that time maybe I didn't have the maturity to see the tragedy in that, you know. I just saw the glorification. So I just remember walking around my English class being like, I hated the Great Gatsby. I read other things. But anyway, Zelda Fitzgerald is a fascinating and also kind of tragic character. She sort of reminds me of like Courtney Love a little bit. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. far, I mean, she's heading down that path. But she also was a really early... She kind of exploded some gender assumptions and barriers in some ways, and like leaving her family of origin and really striking out, marrying for love instead of for social status. So that's all interesting. The fashion is fantastic. It's all the early flapper stuff. Christina Ricci is gorgeous. I haven't seen her forever. What was the last thing she was in?
Oh, Lord. We'd have to IMDb that to really kind of see
Casper.
What she's been up to. Casper and family. No, she's done other things.
She's really great, though.
Z. And the full title is, like, I love it. Z, the beginning of everything.
The beginning of everything.
Beginning of
everything.
Wow.
Okay. Who knew?
So that concludes our episode of Popping Collars. I want to thank everybody who was on with me today. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Ricardo. And a special thanks to our special guest, Selena. Thank
Yay,
you for joining
Selena.
Us.
Yay, Selena.
Yeah.
Thank
yeah. you. You will go far.
She will.
Oh, thank you.
No telling. We are Popping Collars. Oh, good. I'm glad you had fun. And you can find us wherever you get any of your podcast needs met, whether that be SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, wherever. You can also find us on EpiscopalCafe.com. We love Episcopal Cafe, and you will too. Please check them out for all of your Episcopal news needs. And with that is our show. We hope you all have a good night, and take care. Keep those collars popped.
There we go.